This is the Infotagent podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. Hate speech, racist and sexist abuse, and threatening behaviour have become an all too common part of the online experience. There are growing concerns as well that normalising this activity on social media, often by users under the cloak of anonymity, is changing people's behaviours offline as well, with rising levels of violent attacks against people and increasing incidents of self-harm. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, we'll be discussing these issues with Shireen Mitchell, the founder of New York-based Digital Sisters and the campaigning organisation Stop Online Violence Against Women. We'll also be joined by our resident disinformation expert, Dr. Charles Creel. Shireen, it's fantastic to have you with us here on the Infotagent podcast. Perhaps where we should start off is talking about your work in establishing Digital Sisters and your decision to become an advocate on these issues as we start our discussion.
Absolutely. I founded Digital Sisters in 1999 with the intent to create more girls like me. I started coding when I was 10 years old in Harlem in the Bronx, which is an impoverished neighborhood in New York City. As a girl of color, I was constantly told that I couldn't code, even though I could click, and me and the computer were just fine. While everybody else is telling me that it's just not something possible that I could do. And so when I formed Digital Sisters, my goal at that time was to do my best to get more women and girls of color into tech and online. These are some of the early days where we're talking about the digital divide. There are people who didn't even have computers at home. I used to take a laptop, a mobile bag of laptops to conference rooms and the like to help girls get access to technology. That's how early days. I used to call it a laptop jump out. Like, we would try to have these laptops that we were using across the city to engage young people because they didn't even have computers at all at home. What I learned, I tell people all the time, what I learned about that process is that the easiest part of my job is teaching the girls to code. The rest of the problem was the adults around them, their moms, their parents, the school system, the tech industry, politics and policies. And I started getting more involved in the sort of legislative and political side of the issues. At which point in 2013, I formed Stop Online Violence Against Women. That was formed because I saw these different type of activities online tracking women of color behavior, ways in which they were being targeted, ways in which we saw accounts that we found out later in 2016 were pretending to be Black people, but they started out being Black women. And at that time, I had to sit with myself because one of the things I was teaching. When I was teaching the girls to code, I kept saying to the moms who were constantly disconnecting their daughters over their sons, I kept saying to them, your daughters are going to be fine. And now fast forward, I realize at least that that's not necessarily true because the level of harassment and violence, incitement of violence targeted towards women of color in particular, but women in general, is overwhelming. And so at that point, I was like, no, I have to look at this from a different perspective. And that's why I formed Stop Online Violence Against Women.
It's an incredible journey from starting off really looking to get young women involved in the tech sector and give them a chance to develop a career within tech industries and use those tools to quite quickly being in a position where the bigger problem was actually helping people keep themselves safe in the online environment.
No, exactly. To me, when I started to see the type of online targeting, to me, it was the answer. It was finally sort of the answer. It was like, the girls can code. Why aren't there more of them in the industry? And what I started to see was the way in which what I felt was like, we're seeing an online version of how these women are being treated in the industry. Like, that was my interpretation. It's like, I'm trying to get them in. And here's what's happening to them. And why would they stay is the next question, right? Because if this is the kind of harassment, if we can physically all see this harassment now and the way that the level of targeting, then there's a solution here. But that solution has to deal with checking the people who are doing the targeting, not the people who are being victimized by that. And I don't think we've ever gotten to the place to handle any of that. But yeah, it became sort of an eye opener for me, which is why I started looking at this from a different angle and then looking at other ways that this has become impactful. I try to remind people that everyone knows Gamergate. You know Gamergate, right, Damian?
Yeah,
You've heard of Gamergate, right? And the thing about this is that there was something before Gamergate. It was called Donglegate. That woman happened to be a Black woman. That woman was in the tech industry at a conference speaking out about sexism in the tech industry. And there was a coordinated, targeted attack against her. Most people don't even know her name. Most people don't even know that this happened. They land on that the first time they see it organized like this is Gamergate, when that's not true. That's the first time media cared. And in that instance, the way media is in America, when it's something happening to Black and brown people, it's not as important as if it's happening to a white woman who was the starting center of Gamergate. So it very much is this historical narrative that we are constantly having to deal with, but from a social commentary, but definitely very specifically to the tech industry.
I mean, Gamergate is a good example of a sort of a high profile, you know, harassment of people on media. I mean, it was said in the past that if there were more women involved in designing and building products, online products, then they would be better. But do you actually think that there are inherent problems with many of the tools that people use every day online, particularly in social media, which makes targeting and harassment of people, just, you know, unfortunately, so easy, and the systems, you know, really egg people on and encourage people engaged in that behavior to behave in an even more extreme way?
Yes, it does. And there's a community engagement that happens there that makes that acceptable, right? It's like all the moderation processes on these platforms are the types of things that should be moderating this type of behavior, and instead they're allowing it, right? But the thing that you said that I want to just pin as well is, like, when we think about, I think you've heard that the case of Dr. Timnit, you know, she was working in AI and ethics in the tech industry, in the companies that are supposed to be thinking about the ethics of their products and their technology and the AI. And, you know, even with many PhDs and the like, she was discarded because as a Black woman, she was trying to help correct the path that we're going down. And instead of being lauded, she was, removed. And to me, that is the epitome of the lifespan of being a Black woman in particular in tech, but women of color in tech overall. Our inputs and, you know, are not seen as valuable, as actually contrary when we're trying to help fix the system. That also says that some people do not want the system fixed because they benefit from it.
Well, this is it, because I think so many people who've either become whistleblowers or people that have spoken out after having worked in the tech sector say in some ways have a similar story, which is that, you know, I raised this in good faith, thinking the company I worked for would want to do something about it, and was horrified to discover that they actually didn't.
No, I think the recent expose from Julia Wong from The Guardian around Hang speaks to that. She exited, making a statement about trying to solve some of these political ad problems. And then, you know, this, the type of staff, there were fine with the problem clearly. And my understanding is she did not sign an NDA, so she can speak freely about this. And that's another piece that I don't think people understand is, once you're in the system and you're trying to fix it, but it doesn't go exactly the right way, they don't want you talking about it. So they force you to sign NDAs for money. And some people, you know, as they try to go through their careers, can't walk away from that money. So they sign an NDA. I can't remember exactly how much money she walked away from, but my understanding was a lot of money, and not everyone can do that. There are multiple instances where that, you know, the weaponization of vulnerable people and marginalized people is also used as tactics to keep a lot of this stuff silent when there's harms happening to individuals across the board. And in many instances, we're going to get into, a democracy is at risk.
Absolutely. I want to come on to elections shortly, but just, I mean, one of the issues that has had quite a lot of attention in the UK in the last year has been racist abuse targeting celebrities, particularly sports sportsmen and women, quite high profile footballers you know, who've received a huge amount of abuse. And one of my, I mean, firstly, that abuse itself is ugly and horrible, and people use the cloak of anonymity online to say things they wouldn't say in public. But it also creates this sort of this constant drumbeat of abusive behavior, abusive language, dehumanizing language being directed at people. And I think you've got to be concerned about what effect that actually has on people that see that content all the time. And we've seen in the UK, and I think it's similar in America, we've seen in recent years, increases in violent crimes committed against against black people, increasing levels of young girls self-harming. And I think we should be concerned that this online behavior is affecting real world behavior.
No, absolutely. See, the thing is, I really push back on the concept that both of these things are not real world. You know why? Because even if I'm behind an account, I'm a real person, right?
Yeah.
So I'm still expressing my feelings as an individual. How I express my feelings online in many ways can transfer to the way I'm expressing it or not expressing it in person. But I'm still the same person, whether I'm coming on the platforms where people believe that I'm a different persona online than I am in person. That is the conversation I always have with people. I am the exact same person you meet online as you meet in person. Yeah. And I've learned over time, that's a rarity, but that's also the point, right? Sometimes the way that we disconnect and disassociate ourselves from whatever is happening virtually as if these are not people acting and choosing and listening and discerning and making choices, even in the online environment, as any other choices they would make in their lives. And the fact that we are sort of trying to separate the online from the offline just means that we're being disingenuous about our whole person, our whole being, right? I do know, right? We all know that you know, some people get on here trying to show the perfect life that they have when they may not be living a perfect, you know, existence. And, you know, those are kinds of things that we talk about. But overall, right, in some ways, that's just coping mechanisms, right? There's something going on why people would do such a thing. But the same way with this violence that you're talking about, the same kind of targeting. This is people who have evidently whatever issues that they're having personally, taking it out on someone else because they happen to be celebrity status or because they can see them as a target, or they don't like the way these people are living and they think they have a right to determine how people should or should not exist in the world. And they, you know, they go on these platforms and sort of target and harass. The worst of it is when they're threatening people's lives, when they're doxing their families, putting out private information, when they're, you know, sending them horrible images. I've gone through this when a young woman by the name of Corinne Gaines was killed by the police some years ago. When I was speaking up about what happened and what Facebook did, because what Facebook did was take down her, literally, and this is a case that finally got resolved, but what Facebook did was take down her live feed by the request of the police while she was trying to protect herself and her son. And it's evident that as she was doing such, you know, us protecting ourselves is always seen as the problem. As doing so, the police basically shot through windows to kill her and shoot their son. And I spoke about the way that this was, you know, this level of injustice. And now it's been recorded that one of the police officers who shot through the windows was like, I'm sick of this, it's gone on long enough, and just basically shot without even looking.
Yeah, it's police.
And killed her. And her mom finally got her case resolved on that. She was like, my daughter was not wrong. She never was. But let me tell you, as that case was not, you know, solved yet, I had people sending me images of her head either blown off or X's in her, you know, in her images to me to basically scare me, like in a death threat way, right? It's to tell me to be quiet about what I saw as an injustice against another Black person.
Absolutely. And I think The concern I think we should have is that the what people are exposed to online, on social media in particular, is influencing the way they behave offline as mm-hmm. well. People are more likely to commit violent acts, to have hostile views of other people, because they're immersed in an online environment where that behavior has become normalized.
Oh, I agree with that. I agree with that, because they're also in some of these rooms, right? Or not rooms, but I keep thinking rooms right now because I'm on Clubhouse a lot. But on some of these platforms or some of these, like the Reddit, you know, subreddits, you know, the group, you know, the other groups that they now have created where they have these single spaces, they get to go into spaces where everyone agrees with the type of violence that they're inciting. And they feel like they're like, this is a normal behavior when it's, in my opinion, when it's not the majority. But then it gets accepted as such. And yes, there's some people who will act. And, you know, in America right now, we got shootings almost every day at this point. If it's not the police, it's someone going to a facility or randomly shooting people they don't know. It's really challenging and problematic, and I think also emblematic of what has been happening online.
Now, something else I want to ask you about is abuse directed towards young girls and young women, which is an issue that's had quite a lot of attention in the UK in the last few months, and in particular, young girls being subjected to pornographic images, explicit images being sent to them unsolicited, often by young men, and the need to do something about this. And I wonder whether this is a problem that is that has crossed your work in America as well.
No, absolutely. I would say that we have mirrors of these type of examples across the globe. Again, because, you know, internationally, the web makes it possible for us to engage with each other, and see other things happening in other spaces and cultures. But yes, I would say one of the big things here is also about what we call intimate images being shared or being used to threaten or blackmail young women, whether it's intimate partnership or outside of that, the types of threats or intimate images being sent to them to make them uncomfortable, the ways in which their appearance is talked about, their bodies. Are all things that I've seen that has been hugely intimidating, targeting to intimidate young girls in their existence. I'm saying too much, but I just want to make sure that people understand that, like, the most marginalized are targeted, and that's why we're seeing an uptick in young women being harassed and targeted as well.
And there's the problem of direct harassment. Young girls being directly sent images mm-hmm. by young men, and one of the concerns I have there, which is something I don't think is we've ever really stopped to think enough about, is, you know, what is the impact of the lack of age verification for access to adult websites, which can now be readily accessed by teenage boys, boys younger than that, without any real barriers in their way. You know, mm-hmm. what is that having on the psychology of young boys, and is that influencing this behavior? And I think it's something we should take a lot more seriously.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm not even sure, you know, let me say this very candidly. We know that when young people are going through their own bodily changes, that there are aspects of not understanding what to do or how to handle that, and then their own personal social expectations. And yes, whether it's what we've discovered, terms that we use now, the incels who feel like, you know, they don't get access to women who they believe they deserve to have access to, for whatever reason that they are being taught this, that somehow that other women's bodies are some kind of their property in some form. That in itself is also part of why these sort of direct messages are being sent. And there's quite a few. that we had to deal with in different ways. But yes, the ways in which these images, it's not just so much access to porn sites and the like, right? It is the concept that they should have access to these women and these, you know, to these young women, which is why they're sending these types of images to them, right? They feel they have the right to do so. And in some ways, they believe it's like a level of freedom of speech, which is really interesting in terms of like, if you think about it from their perspective, it's like, well, this is what I'm interested in. You know, I should be able to do this freely while harming other people is not part of the care or concern that they have. And it's still more about this is their perspective in the world, and they should have access to young women, no matter who those women are. And that's a failing of our society in general, but that we really do have to have better conversations with young men about how to handle their own sexual challenges and not expose other people to what they're sort of trying to, you know, go through.
I mean, we know that there's been, you know, there are problems on mainstream social media sites of, you know, closed groups where harmful content is shared, some of that explicit, some of that illegal. And that's a constant battle, it seems, to get the tech companies to do more to close those things down. But there's also, mm-hmm. I think, the problem of content that is harmful may not be, you know, as explicit as this, but it's still harmful, which the recommendation tools of social media direct young people to, particularly young girls. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think this is, you know, we've seen issues with this on Instagram in particular, or issues around, you know, extreme weight loss, body image, depression, even suicidal thoughts. But I think I'm increasingly concerned as well about TikTok's role in this too, because, you know, Facebook curates a feed based on people that you follow. TikTok curates a feed of content for you just based on what you've interacted with on TikTok alone. Just you're mm-hmm. following the accounts. And that would seem to me, you know, potentially, if that algorithm is biased towards serving you more harmful content because you've engaged with it in the past, then you're going to see, as we know, even more of it.
No, absolutely. I think TikTok is one example. I think YouTube is another example. If you're on Clubhouse, that's an audio version of that example. So like, I think that, and it's so interesting to see that this is content that is either, they're both audio, but one is audio and video. And I do find it very interesting in terms of the ways in which the algorithms make suggestions back to you. And you might've just seen something and clicked on it just because, you know, you were curious for whatever you thought you were looking at or seeing. And then it'll automatically try to feed you that additional information. So yes, we've seen many instances where people go down rabbit holes and then they only see that content over and over and over again, instead of additional content that kind of can get them out of that. So I totally agree. I'm going to go back to Dr. Timnit because that's what she was trying to deal with. It's like the ethics in AI. Like, how do we fix that kind of thing? If this, one, is it being built this way intentionally? But two, in my opinion, you know, we still don't want to deal with the humans behind that, which is the people who are building these, you know, these AI applications and the like. And like, what are their biases that they're building into the system? And then what is the system learning? And pushing back out. Like, we know that when Microsoft tried this on Twitter, I think it was Tay is the name of it. When they put an AI on Twitter, the AI turned racist, harmful, anti-Semitic, and all of that was being fed by humans, right? And so it's like, not, we're sort of ignoring some of the fundamental problems of this in the first place, especially from the AI perspective. Like, we are feeding the machine. Yeah. The machine is spitting it back to us. And that's a reflection on us, not the machine.
That's right. But I think humans still built the machine as well, didn't they? Some people talk about AI, particularly, you know, people from the tech companies, they make it sound like a sort of a creature with independent thought rather than tool that they themselves have created.
No. A human built it. And they built it with their own biases in place.
Now, you mentioned elections earlier on. I just wanted to ask you about that, because there was a very good Channel 4 expose following up on the Cambridge Analytica case and the quest of Professor David Carroll from New York, who's been a guest on this show, where he was trying to get his data back from Cambridge Analytica. And what that investigation from Channel 4 News exposed was the significant amount of voter suppression activity on Facebook in the 2016 presidential election, particularly directed at black communities in America. And this to me seems like a very significant part of this story about the significance of data profiling in politics. I think there was initially everyone was very interested in what the Russians were doing, but actually in some ways this is more sinister and may even have had a bigger influence on the election.
No, I mean, from American perspective, the type of profiling that you're talking about, they would call it micro-targeting, right? That's the sort of quote-unquote academic name of that. The problem with the micro-targeting is as well as we talked about with the AI, is what you do with it. What are you trying to target and what are you trying to shift? And I thought, so you're leading into the work that we started with Stop Digital Voter Suppression after we first looked at those 3,500 ads that the Russian IRA had used to influence the election in 2016. We put out the first report that basically indicated that Black identity was the weapon of choice, basically, for that interference. And when we put that first report out, like, it was not understood to be specifically Black identified. There was a lot of conversation that race was included and it stayed very general. But what we did was we took those 3,500 ads and did a data visual analysis of those ads. And we saw a completely different visual. And in our visual, we could see how much they were spending, how much they like the terms they were triggering out of the AI to get access to Black and Brown people. One, to gain trust, and then two, to then send them information that was disinformation, which we call digital voter suppression, to dissuade them from participating in the elections in different ways. And that included things such as what we consider illegal in general is telling people the wrong places to go to vote, telling them the wrong dates, telling them they could text their vote, which is not possible in this country. And there's a list of things that we can talk about in terms of like what the actual message is, which was roughly about, I would say the activation happens about 2 to 3 weeks before the actual election. We saw this uptick, and it was very evident what the uptick was for, using images of Black women's faces, using logos that looks like it was HRC logos. There's a distance of things that we saw during 2016 that was really interesting, that was specifically targeted on Black identity. And in this country, even Russia has participated in propaganda during the civil rights movement. So it's not new. It's just the use of the social media platforms, a digital version of what has now become, in my opinion, a digital version of Jim Crow. Because what started out as a campaign, one example that I will give you, as I talked about the digital visualization, one example of the hashtag campaigns during that time was Stop the Steal. That was pre-2016. And here we have domestic actors using that, including people running for office, that led up to an actual physical insurrection. And now we have 47 states with 361 bills trying to stop Black people from voting.
And with the data micro-targeting, I thought there was an interesting debate on that ahead of the election this time around, which was whether these ad tools are appropriate. And I take the view that I think in politics, that sort of micro-targeting of people based on their race, their religion, their political affiliations and opinions shouldn't be allowed. And YouTube indeed turned off their customer match tool during the election, so it couldn't be used for political ads. And do you think we basically just need fundamental reform of the way people can be micro-targeted around political content on social media?
No, I agree. I mean, do you want me to talk more about that? I mean, honestly, like I completely agree that I think we're like, sometimes people want to look at solutions and they're not looking at the actual solutions. Like, one is AI as a possible solution, but the other is this micro-targeting ability. Like, we need to be thinking about this in a different way. I think that initially, just like everything with tech, is that this was supposed to save people and do the, you know, be the best that we can be, without accepting the fact that we still have bad actors who can use the same tools in a completely opposite way, right? And that, to me, is what happened with the micro-targeting. Because I think, as you said, you had a Channel 4 expose that showed how, I have a name for him, so I'm going to not do it on air, but that showed how the previous president of the United States had literally participated in disinformation campaigns and voter suppression campaigns in 2016, what happened in 2016, and also accelerated in 2020 with Stop the Steal. But they had a campaign using that micro-targeting with the likes of content and data from Cambridge Analytica, from Russia, and the like, that that was focused on deterring Black people from voting. Like, they had it to a micro level of individual framing that you can show up to show up to a voter's home to participate in them in this deterrence, is what they called it. But that, we call it digital vote suppression, by the way. But that is the type of aspect of what these platforms are pretending that they don't understand as to why that democratic influence can happen. Particularly if this type of micro-targeting includes political ads that is not being moderated for accurate content and accurate information. If they're basically saying, we're going to allow the micro-targeting, we're not going to deter or shut down ads that are disingenuous or spreading disinformation that have impacts on the election, on any election across the globe, because we know that other leaders, you know, politicians, dictators have used these platforms to misinform, as I talked about the Wong and Hang piece, that we know that they had, you know, been using these platforms to misinform their own citizens and to incite violence against them, which is, in my opinion, in American standards, our freedom of speech is actually our freedom to speak against the government, not the government's right to speak against us. And that level of protection is not granted.
Well, it was interesting because I think in the last year, we've seen interesting cases, important cases, you know, about the where the frontier lies between people's freedom of speech, their First Amendment rights in America, and the harm that speech can cause other people. And the insurrection in Washington on the 6th of January is a good example of that, how it wasn't just that Donald Trump and his supporters were continuing to propagate a lie that the election had been a mass fraud, but we're actually inciting people to take to the streets and protest in it, and a protest where people lost their lives. But we discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago this issue, and I think it's interesting that the piece of Supreme Court case law, the Brandenburg case versus the state of Ohio, is based on the case of the Ku Klux Klan, and incitement to violence and harm there. But again, we see, you know, racially motivated speech, you know, hate speech, being a key factor in that decision as well.
It's so interesting that, like, you know, we have to go back to this. Oh, well, that's what I was trying to say. It's like, this has happened before. It just happened in a different venue, in a different way. Like, we're doing it from a digital perspective, but you're absolutely right with that case. When you have to reenact the Ku Klux Klan clause, we're at a precipice in this country, particularly, where we're repeating certain parts of our history and not acknowledging it, and so many people are identifying it as a level of freedom of speech or a level of protest. There's a difference, and that's another thing that's happening, is that they're trying to compare what happened on January 6th to what happened over the summer with the Black Lives Matter protests, where we're protesting in Black Lives Matter against the state so that the state will stop killing us. And what was happening at the insurrection was people being upset at our ability to vote and then going to try to change the vote. Those are two completely different things. That's not against the state. That's against us. And now, again, we have 47 states and 361 bills based on that incitement to violence and insurrection and targeting our, you know, Black voters. And I think that a lot of times it's not even said that way, because I don't think people understand the gravity of the history of this country, of what Jim Crow was. I think when we use terms that make people feel comfortable, we don't understand the length and breadth and depth of it. And sometimes I have to say, you know, Jim Crow was violent. There was lynchings. These people enacted a lynch mob on January 6th with a hanging stock right outside the building. That's completely different than protesting against the government to stop being killed and to change policies, right? It's a completely different thing. You're trying to change an entire election, and the law that was passed in Georgia literally allows state legislators to go to counties that they don't agree with the outcomes and change that. How is that democracy?
Absolutely right. And I mean, you're right to say that, you know, we've seen these problems before. But the problem we're dealing with now, it would seem to me, is the consequences of the amplification of hate by mm-hmm. social media, the ability to do that. Whereas, you know, to get a message out in a repeated way and targeted at the people most likely to be influenced by it. And in the past, even in the late 60s, with the birth of like color television and mass media playing a bigger part, audiovisual mass media playing a bigger part in people's lives. Even then, it's very different from where we are today with the personalization of news and information being used as a weapon to spread hate.
Absolutely. Because I think Kara Swisher, I think, who's also on the Facebook, Real Facebook Oversight Board with us, she said multiple times, this isn't just one message getting out there, right? This is to thousands of people, at least a million times. Right, which is drastically different than what we were able to do before with pamphlets at the door, what Russia was doing back then, right? Or what any sort of influence campaign was trying to promote, a disinformation campaign. It's a drastically different impact. It's a drastically different influence. And right now, based on the numbers, disinformation spreads literally 6 to 1. So you only get out of every piece of, you know, it's also an ad model a little bit, right? Ad models, the person has to see it 7 times. Well, yeah, these people have seen it millions of times, and hate is being spread millions of times through these platforms. When even Facebook has admitted that they have an AI that can remove hate speech before anyone sees it, right? So but they have the AI, but they are not deploying it. Because one political party content would be taken down over another. And instead of saying out loud, I don't care which party it is, as far as I'm concerned, but instead of saying out loud that this party clearly is participating in hate speech, they're saying, we're just not going to deploy the AI. Yeah. That's a human choice.
Exactly. It's a choice they make, and they're responsible for that choice. And I think what we've got to do now is try and create some enforceable standards that judge them on the choices they make and take action against them accordingly.
Absolutely. Like if that choice was made, then we need to react to that choice, because why isn't that AI? Like, it's so funny. It's like somehow we know this AI has some solutions for us, but then we're picking and choosing which AI we want to deploy. Like, that's a human choice. Yeah. It's not the AI in that instance. Right. And so, and this was discussed in many of these exposés. And so this is not something we hadn't been discussing before. This is just the concept that people don't realize. It's like, these are actions being taken that's allowing the algorithms to work in a certain way, and also allowing hate speech to flourish. And in some ways, using that hate speech flourishing as increasing valuation, because it shows an increase in activity. Increasing streams and an increase in engagement, but that increasing engagement is causing harms to certain groups of people, and they're shrugging about those harms. We know that there was a state organized a sponsored genocide of Myanmar on Facebook. Just like we know that Russia was able to organize and interfere in the American elections. We also know there are other countries that are participating now because it works. Yeah. And instead of fixing it and addressing it, we're coming up with all these excuses, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think these are issues we discuss all the time on this podcast. And I hope this year will finally be the year where we start to bring forward legislation to start enforcing some of these standards and holding the big tech companies responsible for what they allow to happen on the systems that they themselves have created. But Shireen, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been great to chat to you, and look forward to continue working with you on the Real Facebook Oversight Board.
Definitely. We have a lot of work to do, by the way. And if you ever want me to come back and have more of this conversation, let's feel free to do so, because a lot of it needs to be talked about more often. So thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much.
Charles, it's great to have you with us again. Tell us, what's caught your attention in the last few weeks?
Thanks, Damien. Two notes from China this week. First up, CGTN, this is the Chinese state television broadcaster, recently published an article defending the regime against allegations of genocide against the Uyghurs. This by itself isn't unusual, given that disinformation is the Chinese Communist Party's go-to strategy. But what makes this story strange is that the article is signed off by a French journalist, Laurent Beaumont, who works for Le Monde. Now, that is unusual, a defense of Chinese genocide mounted by a mainstream French journalist, so I dug in a bit. Now, according to the Chinese broadcaster's bio of Beaumont, he graduated from the Sorbonne with a double degree in art history and archaeology before going on to complete a journalism master's, and the bio says he worked for several French newspapers before taking up a position in Beijing for Le Monde. Great credentials, but it turns out the thing is, he doesn't exist at all. In France, most journalists are registered with a special commission that issues press cards, like the UK's National Union of Journalists. Le Monde says his name doesn't exist in the commission's database, and they can't find anyone in the industry who's heard of him. They also say that Beaumont's comments on the Uyghur genocide reflect the talking points of the CCP, so it's a clumsy piece of propaganda overall. And this brings me to our second item. July 1st is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. So to celebrate, Chinese authorities have announced that every cinema in the country will have to screen at least two propaganda films per week celebrating the party. And on top of that, the National Alliance of Arthouse Cinemas at the People's Cinema Circuit will screen a propaganda film every day. That's more than 5,000 venues with special halls dedicated to propaganda films. Now, the films are said to, quote, closely focus on the themes of loving the party, loving the nation, and loving socialism, and will sing the praises of and eulogize the party, the motherland, its people, and its heroes. The first batch of films were announced this month, and they include titles like Fighting North and South, Railway Guerrilla, and The Red Detachment of Women. All of that according to Variety.
You've been listening to the Infotainment podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Shireen Mitchell and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagenPodcast. Infotagen is a not-for-profit organisation, and all proceeds will go towards the making of this podcast. Thank you. Until next time.